afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. James Corbett of the Corbett Report will be joining the program right after the first segment is over, and I will be doing his interview. I was able to spend I had the opportunity to talk with James, and I truly did enjoy spending the time with him, and I hope and I'm sure you will also enjoy the time that I was able to spend with James here in the second and third segment of the program today. So James Corbett of the Corbett Report will be here with me. I had a blast doing it. It was fun. I enjoyed it. It was interesting. So make sure you stay tuned, and I will try to make this first segment just as interesting for you right after we get to the market report for Friday, March 2nd, 2018. So let's go to gold today. And of course, you know, all the talk was still about the tariffs and so forth. And you know what's really interesting? I mean, Trump made the announcement yesterday, but we reported on these tariffs back in the middle of February. We talked about they were looking to do steel and aluminum. So, you know, it is surprising to see that the markets reacted the way they did, considering this is something that, you know, has been being floated around since the middle of February. With the percentages and on the various countries, who would be affected, who wouldn't be affected. So, again, it's surprising to see the markets react and the reaction to these politicians and so forth. So I view it as just a distraction, ladies and gentlemen. But we got a little bump out of gold for the past 2 days, so gold was up, and I'll take it. Gold was up $5.20 today at $1,323. Silver was up 3 cents today at 1660. Platinum was down a buck at 968. And palladium was up $4 at $994. So we had a little bit of pressure on the dollar today, down 0.31 at 89.95. Crude oil was up 24 cents today at 61.23. Paper markets today, you had the down, you know, it was down, you know, 300 points all day long. But they were able to bring it back. I'm showing down 70, 24,538. The NASDAQ was up 77 points at 72.57, and the S&P was up 13 at 26.91. They don't want to go into a weekend with negative numbers. 10-year yield today was up 0.05 also at 2.86%. Euro was stronger. Japan had a tough day, down 2.5%. Hong Kong was down 1.5%, and it's interesting, the extreme fear gauge that I talk about, the fear and greed index, was down to 8. So I believe yesterday it was 12, and it dropped back down to 8. It was 12 or 17, and they brought it back to 8. So markets really aren't reflecting any fear. So it's kind of interesting to have that number as low as it does. And, well, maybe there's a little fear, but there certainly is no panic. There is no panic in these markets. So the stocks fluctuated, and we did have the steep losses on those tariff proposals, as I mentioned, but not a bad day for gold. You know, it's interesting, we hear all the chatter that has been focused on the steel and aluminum tariffs that was announced yesterday by President Trump. The European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker issued a strongly worded statement in response to Trump's decision to impose these tariffs. He said that they're going to take the fight to the World Trade Organization. But I think, as I mentioned yesterday, you know, as long as it's a security threat to the United States, there's not a whole lot that the World Trade Organization can do. But Juncker said that there's unfair measures that puts thousands of European jobs at risk. Well, now maybe they'll feel how we've been feeling for the past how many years. Canada, the biggest foreign supplier of steel and aluminum to the U.S., said that the measures were unacceptable. You know, we always seem to forget that Trump is a negotiator. And when you do negotiate, you don't negotiate from the point where you want to end up at. You put the you know, he put something out there so far to the extreme and so forth, knowing that that's what you're going to negotiate from, and you'll come back to the center. And so, you know, everybody gives up something and then you come to an agreement. That's what negotiations are all about. But you know what? It's a dangerous game to play, particularly with our, you know, particularly with our lives. I mean, you're playing with something that can lead to war. And we've talked about currency wars. We've talked about trade wars. Could it also lead to another type? Could it lead to nuclear war? Probably not. Because if we went to nuclear war over trade, then there wouldn't be any trade at all. So I don't think it's going to lead there. But you can see, you know, other countries making other agreements. And of course, yeah, it could have a negative impact on us, not a positive one. So again, but when you're if you're playing a dangerous game with trade and with tariffs, what other games are you willing to play in negotiating? And that's what I said. I don't like deals. I don't want my government to make deals. There's just something wrong about it. We shouldn't be in that position to where we have to make deals. But you know, maybe, you know, and I'm just talking here off the cuff, maybe it's Trump's biggest mistake that he thinks as president that he can still change things. But if you believe in the new world order and the grips in which they hold world governments, I mean, leaders are only puppets. We've seen it in those who preceded Trump. You know, they don't have all the answers, don't have the tools or even the solutions to solve the multitude of problems that this country faces and has. So, and my question is, maybe this is why we're seeing his close personal allies all jumping ship. I mean, you know, it's been a year and all of those that helped him become elected through his campaign, they're just about all gone. And I saw a report today, McMaster's might be leaving. So you read all kinds of lists of the accomplishments of this administration. And there's a lot of little ones, but the biggies, I'd have to say he can boast about Gorsuch, the Supreme Court nominee and acceptance. Gorsuch, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. You know, all presidents have done so, but he is the only one that is moving the embassy to Jerusalem. And he got the tax cuts passed. But, you know, it doesn't really matter if you were very wealthy, the multinational corporations, doesn't matter who they voted for, whether it had been Hillary or Donald. They did get a good deal. And what did the Americans get in those tax? We still have Obamacare that's killing us, eating us up out of our disposable incomes when insurance premiums jump, and I'm healthy, jump 75%. Families that were barely paying anything that got some sort of subsidy, maybe with the family of four, all of a sudden now it's $26,000 or $20,000 plus. How can people afford that? Can you imagine when you was raising a family, even if your health insurance was $10,000 or $15,000, who could afford that when you're raising a family? So we didn't get anything out of Obamacare. And the tax cut, well, you know what, perhaps the lucky ones, maybe they got a one-time bonus. But compared to what the multinational corporations and the super rich got, there is no comparison. What we got, it's basically nothing. So, again, we'll see how the terrorists, and, you know, you can debate both sides. Oh, it's going to be great. It's not going to be great and so forth. But, and we don't even have the details yet. I mean, as I said, we've been talking about the tariffs since the middle of February. You know, Trump makes the announcement. And so it's a big distraction, and we'll have to follow this and see what happens. J.C. Penney today announced that it's going to cut 360 jobs at its stores and corporate headquarters. And this is on top of the more than the 5,000 layoffs they had in 2017. J.C. Penney decided to close nearly 140 stores. They said that its earnings and sales for this year will be worse than what Wall Street analysts were expecting. And you had J.C. Penney, their shares plunged nearly 10% today in early trading. Saw the same thing with Barnes and Noble. They posted a quarterly loss and a big drop in sales yesterday morning, and that sent their shares to an all-time low. Again, the retailers, Victoria's Secrets, their stocks plunged 14% yesterday. Nordstrom's, they fell 6% this morning. Foot Locker, they also had a weaker than expected outlook. Best Buy, now this is what cracks me up, but well, it doesn't crack me up, but Best Buy, they posted strong sales at its stores and digital operations yesterday. The electronics retailer stock even rose 4%. But they announced today that they might be laying some folks off. So again, it kind of makes you wonder, whether or not you post strong earnings and so forth, you might still be closing some of your stores. But the one thing that we can always take comfort in, temporarily at least, is the American consumer is still alive and well. But total student debt in America now exceeds the cost of the Iraqi war. How's that for a headline? According to data from the Federal Reserve, the total amount of student debt in the United States is now $1.5 trillion. That's more than the estimated $1.3 trillion in direct costs that the government spent fighting the war in Iraq. Well, that's the ones that they admit. They don't talk about how much they lost and how much cash they, just gave away and so forth. But on the books, we'll just take with what numbers they got on the books. And what's even more bizarre is the amount that the government actually owns of these student loans, a little over $1 trillion. Student loans actually constitute the number one asset. It compromises about 30% of its balance sheet. So, there was a piece of legislation that was signed into law back in the Clinton administration, back in the late 90s, to where it makes it almost impossible to discharge any type of student debt. So we might see some changes on that coming up from this administration. So unlike any other type of debt, like a home mortgage or medical debt, student debt is extremely difficult to wipe away through bankruptcy procedures. Before we head into break, I didn't have enough time to absorb the fallout from these statements from BlackRock, but it really bugged me, and I wanted to share it with you. BlackRock is the world's largest asset manager, and they detail, they're taking an approach to take action on guns. And they may use voting power to influence. So it's approached the gun industry. They did a three-page letter in response. BlackRock says that it's showing customers options for changing their investments to exclude stocks of gun makers and is considering new funds that don't invest in the industry. BlackRock and the other large passive fund managers haven't been vocal activists in the past, so they're breaking the silence on this on the current gun debate. In a client update outlining its approach to the gun industry today, BlackRock said last month's deadly shooting in Florida has driven home for the firm the terrible toll from gun violence and something that requires response and action from a wide range of entities across both the public and private sectors. That includes, it says, possibly voting against directors or against management on shareholder proposals. And so they're going to continue to explore these options for changing their investments to exclude gun industry stocks. They see BlackRock and, BlackRock, Carlyle, these huge managers. BlackRock oversees over $5 trillion of assets. for major pensions and endowments, as well as your mom and pop fund investors. Much of that is in funds that track market indexes. As such, it is the biggest owner of two publicly traded gun makers and the second biggest in a third one, putting it in a position to influence the current debate on guns. That isn't a powerful fund companies like BlackRock and its rivals have typically wielded. Their mission was to their customers. Their missions were to be successful in providing returns to their clients. And now all of that is changing to now they want to make a statement. And so, you know, that is, you know, we talked about these stores. Can they raise the age to 21? I don't think so. So now do these, you know, you have Delta and you had another airlines, American Airlines, who, you know, have broken their contracts or their agreements with the NRA for providing discounts to NRA members, to the NRA membership. You know, that's their right. But now you have BlackRock who holds $5 trillion in assets, manages $5 trillion in assets, saying, you know, I guess we can pretty much put these companies out of business. And there's something wrong when they can wield that much power, because then you also have to think, what other power do they have? And of course, I'm talking about DC. I'm talking about the politicians, and so they have a lot of control. And so when you see things and you look behind the scenes, you follow the money, and of course, nothing is truly as it seems, but very dangerous, I believe. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. We're going to continue the special on the Mint State 61 $20 Liberty gold pieces along with the 1 ounce American gold bullion coin. With each coin that you purchase, you'll receive a free silver eagle. And if you purchase two items, two gold coins, you'll receive also free shipping. It's a great deal, and we adjust those prices to the spot price. So we're basically adjusting the Mint State 61 $20 gold pieces based on spot prices. Now, are my wholesale prices based on that? No. This is how I'm able to give you this special. So I adjusted my prices both in the bullion. I adjusted my prices, not wholesale prices, but my prices with the $20 gold pieces in order to give you a very great deal. 1-800-375-4188. I'm going to be heading into a break, and I hope you enjoy my conversation that I had with James Corbett as much as I enjoyed having the conversation with him. So stay tuned, folks, and we'll be right back.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, and I'm Melody Cederstrom. And thank you for sharing your time with me and my guest today, James Corbett of the Corbett Report. And I'm sure you're all familiar with Mr. Corbett, the Corbett Report, which was started in 2007. And James also is an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, the weekly e-newsletter that was created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. Hi, James. It's great to have you back today. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for having me on, as always.
Great. Well, you know, we were talking off air coming into this segment, and this is the first time you and I have a shared radio time together, so I'm very excited to ask you some questions. And everyone that I talk to, my clients and my listeners, they always want to know what's going on around the world. And, of course, because you're in Japan, they expect you to know exactly what's going on in Japan and elsewhere in the world today in Asia. So my very broad question what's going on? And
Let me just give you the round the world tour.
Around the world.
I understand people's interest, because it's my interest too. What is going on around the world, and what do people need to know about? So on the financial front, I think it's interesting to note that just another sign that we're living in the interconnected global economy that has been carefully engineered over decades is the fact that the Asian stocks are currently, well, have taken a bit of a tumble based on everyone collectively holding their breath over the second part of Jay Powell's second ever testimony to the House Banking Committee, I believe, where he is testifying this week. People might remember he started on Tuesday and made some comments that shook the markets to their core. He said that the Fed might consider another interest rate hike this year on top of the three they've already predicted. There may be a fourth. He's not prejudging it. And, of course, the markets went into a tizzy because, as we know, the world markets are completely controlled and completely propped up by the central banks at this point. So any pronouncement from the Federal Reserve chairman must mean something, you know, taken down from Mount Sinai and written on tablets. So this sent everyone into a tizzy, including Asian markets. And so we've had a bit of a pullback here in the last couple of days as people are waiting for the rest of his testimony and seeing if there's any more scrying of the tea leaves they can do as to what might happen with the Federal Reserve rates. And I just think that's telling as to the world that we're living in, that the pronouncements of the Federal Reserve Chair really are literally felt around the world at this point.
You know, I remember, I think it was Greenspan, and I said this a couple of times on the program, could have been Bernanke, but it was one of the two, and they said, as far as the Fed, it's not so much the changes we make in monetary policy, but it's more of what we speak that can change and move markets, and it's what people pay attention to. So people pay very little attention to what we actually do, but it's what we speak, it's what we say.
Yeah, and I can remember that throughout my entire life. I grew up, I started my political and economic consciousness in the Greenspan era, and I certainly remember every time he spoke, it was, oh, what did he say? And this word was a little bit different than the word he used last time, and what does that mean? And it's so it, and this is part of that mystique that surrounds the central banking cult at this point, where it is these wizards who are, you know, engineering the economy, and their wise pronouncements will be taken so seriously and scrutinized to the nth degree. And as you say, it's not even the moves themselves so much as, you know, everyone trying to rush to price themselves into the market based on what they believe might be happening based on this word or that word. So it really is kind of a strange, it almost feels like a cultish kind of thing, yeah, that's happened. But it has real-world implications, obviously. The Fed rate hikes and all of this does have some implications for the economy. So there's some basis to it. But I think it just goes to show the kind of phony baloney nature of what we take to be the signs of the economy, the signposts of the economy. Why do we measure the economy in terms of the Dow Jones or the S&P rather than the actual real productive activity that's going on? Maybe a PMI or something like that might be an actual better window into the economy itself.
Well, it used to be until all the markets began to be manipulated. And what I find fascinating is, and as you just said a few seconds ago, the world is synchronized of stimulus. I mean, they've got it all together. You have all of this stimulus coming into all these major world economies, with nothing other than perhaps a little talk of, you know, shutting off the spigot a little bit. You get some reactions. And Japan, of course, you know, we hear about, you know, their stimulus is, you know, all forward ahead, no changing, yeah, and nothing seems to matter. You have all these world economies; they're all an illusion,
right?
And it's fascinating.
And as I pointed out in the Forecaster recently, as you say, the stimulus here in Japan, the central bank governor here, Kuroda, talked. Floated the idea, just mentioned the idea that they might be ready to start putting the brakes on that stimulus, not even actually stopping it, just paring back a little bit. And the markets here went into a tizzy over that. And so it kind of retracted, and to the point where after he was appointed for a second term, he comes back and with a team that is almost guaranteed to continue, if not expand, the stimulus. So the markets have spoken, and they've gotten what they want, which is another fix of the heroin that they've become addicted to, the stimulus money from heaven. And it's the same here in Japan. It's that's what the U.S. recovery of the past decade was all about. That's what's happening with the ECB in Europe. It is a coordinated event going on right now, and we should have seen that or known that from the response to the Lehman crisis and the financial crisis of 2008 was, of course, in 2009, the G20 meeting and the coordinated central bank actions to lower rates and to start providing stimulus. That was a coordinated action that they admitted to, the first ever coordinated central bank actions. Well, now it may or may not be more or less over the table or under the table, but there is still a large degree of concert between the major central banks and right, the stimulus they're providing, and this is what is dictating the global economy at this point.
Do you ever believe these economies, these world economies, will ever get to the point to where they can actually run on their own, to where they could actually cut back the stimulus? I know that's I'd have to. I know my answer to that, but what's yours?
Well, I would say it's remarkably unlikely, given the size of the bubble that's been blown, and it's not
exactly
just a stock bubble. It's not just a bond bubble. It's not just a real estate bubble. It, as Mike Maloney and others have been calling it, it's the everything bubble. It's all of these things simultaneously. Which, I mean, hello. I mean, this is 101 kind of stuff. That cannot happen unless there is some sort of bubble inflation going on right now, and that's exactly what this stimulus has been. So the only way out of it, other than the pop, is to grow the economy into that bubble. But what on earth is going to grow the economy that quickly, that much, unless there's some truly game-changing, you know, free energy or some, you know, amazing scientific discovery or something that completely changes our understanding of the universe, maybe then our, you know, economy could grow to match. But barring something truly titanic like that, one wonders. And, of course, the only other possibility is, well, the collapse of markets and economic calamity often tend to go hand in hand with geopolitical conflict, which is, of course, the other worrying side of all this.
Do the fellow citizens in Japan, do they recognize the fact of the problems of the stimulus, and do they understand unlike the people here in the United States. They just kind of go thinking that they're going along for the ride and everything's great and fine. Or is there a, you know, more of a recognition of the problems, but yeah, there's nothing that they can do about it?
Well, I think there is a certain sense of hopelessness here that's been ingrained over the past three decades of this deflationary spiral that Japan's been caught in. I think they just Japan has really just gotten a taste of everything of the sort of new normal before everyone else did. So they're already conditioned to it over the course of the last generation, really, of no growth whatsoever. And it's to the point where there really isn't. There's certainly not a political out at this point. The ruling party, which has been in power for almost the entirety of the post-war period, continues to be in power, and there's no real viable political alternative at the ballot box that people might hope for a change from. And the Abenomics, that of course was going to be the thing that was going to transform the Japanese economy, well, we have had several quarters in a row of GDP growth, the first time in, I think, something like 27 years or something approaching that. The Japanese corporations, there's just a survey that came out. The results show that most corporations do not plan a base pay rise this year. So the entire point of all this stimulus and getting the Nikkei index up and all of this, theoretically, was that this would, of course, it would filter down to the workers, and that, you know, we'd actually see some rise in pay, and that would transform into rise in consumer spending, and that would grow the Japanese economy out of this deflationary spiral. Well, it still hasn't happened, even after years of this failed Abenomics policy, and even after some actual good economic news coming out. Corporations still aren't buying into it and still aren't ready to actually raise workers' wages. So I think the average worker here still feels a little bit trapped in the despair of it all.
You know, there's a lot of discussions here in the States. This is kind of one of my pet peeves. There's a lot of discussions. There's tests that are being done around the world. Stockton, California is starting their own program to test this. Universal basic income. Is that ever discussed in Japan or...
We haven't gotten to that stage of the discussion yet. One could imagine that that might be one of the things that they pull out of the hat when the demographic crisis that's baked into the cake here really starts to hit home. Because, again, even if we did have some sort of boom in the economy and something really, really changed and everything was going tickety-boo, there's still that demographic time bomb that's ticking of literally a dying country that is shrinking by the year and only going to increase in that acceleration of that shrinking every single year. So that is the big question. How do you grow yourself out of that when the workforce itself is shrinking and the aging population is getting bigger and bigger and the actual productive workers are getting smaller and smaller, especially in a country that has been historically quite closed off to any sort of immigration? So it's just a dying country at this point. And so what do you do with that? I mean, will there be some sort of universal basic income idea or some kind of radical idea that that gets tried out in Japan? One could imagine that might be a testing ground for that type of radical policy, given the types of radical challenges that Japan is facing.
Well, you know, when you said a dying country, it's like, you know, where do you go from there? You know, you're right. I mean, how do you turn it around? Or certainly challenges,
especially when it's not just a dying country, it's an aging country. It is some of the longest lived people on the planet, I believe the longest life expectancy, and now you're a few years ago even they were selling more adult diapers than baby diapers. And that's again, that disparity is only increasing. So there's more and more retirees, fewer and fewer workers. There's just no way around it. There's no way within the current economic paradigm and the way that the entire economy is structured that demands growth, constant growth. There's no way to do that in a dying and shrinking population.
You know, I was reading an article, if I don't remember correctly, it was Japan. Well, since we've had the Florida shooting a couple of weeks ago, I believe it is Japan. There, you are allowed to own weapons, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, but .. Yeah, you theoretically kind of can, and there are hunters and some sports shooters and things who do have licenses. But for the average person to get a license to have a firearm here is exceptionally difficult, and they make it that way on purpose. The police will interview you and your family and your employers and your school teachers and everyone you've ever known, and there's 18 million pieces of paperwork, and you have to do all sorts of tests and things like this, and then maybe they'll allow you to have a gun. And basically the only people who get through that process are people who have grown up in traditional kind of hunting areas, or policemen, retired policemen, that kind of thing. But the average person here, just there's no real access to guns.
Well, it was pretty much what the article said, but it made it sound like there was more and more people that had actually owned them than what you're relating to. So, again, just a little, you know, media again, and the way articles are written, but very interesting.
Well, hey, I mean, I don't know everyone, and I don't know the stats, but...
I believe you over the article.
Well, I can tell you from my own experience, I have yet to have a gun in Japan.
Is that right? All right. It's been a little quiet with North Korea, and certainly there has been... you had missiles flying over certain parts. Has that seemed to have calmed... in your neck of the woods?
Yeah. Well, I think we're all kind of holding our breath as to what the next step after this Olympic diplomatic offensive, as it's sometimes called, what results from that. Because obviously at the Olympics there were the overtures, and of course, Kim Jong-un sent his sister as an envoy to invite the South Korean president over to a summit in North Korea and all of this. So there are some diplomatic things that are happening and some perhaps hopeful signs, but again, it depends on ultimately it's not even a question of the Korean Peninsula, it's a question of the U.S. and China and Japan, and what are, you know, how are they going to react to this. So the latest that I've heard is that the North Korean representative to some disarmament conference or other has said basically to the U.S. We will respond to any provocations that you bring in trying to get between us and South Korea in our diplomatic initiatives. So, again, it's always on if not on a knife edge, at least it could go either way. But there is at least a bit of a, everyone's holding their breath at the moment, because there might be a chance for some lessening of the tension.
Do you believe there's that chance?
I do think so. I really do. I think ultimately, I mean, in the long run, the Korean people and the Korean Peninsula will be, if not united politically, will at least come to some sort of agreement. I mean, you can't keep a people divided like that artificially for that long. I just don't believe that. But it can be certainly prolonged by the outside forces and powers that have a vested interest in what's happening in Korean Peninsula, not because of Korea itself, but because of what it represents geostrategically. So I think the more that it can be between South and North Korea and negotiations between them, and the less about the foreign outside powers, the better it'll be.
Well, then my next question is, which is more of a, I don't know if threat's the proper word to use, or concern, North Korea then, or China?
Or the U.S.
I mean,
you know, really, it's all connected, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
any sort of nuclear... any sort of nuclear deployment anywhere on the peninsula or anywhere else would seemingly necessitate some sort of all-out confrontation, which of course is humanity has to be very much against and very much worried about at this point. So it's an open question, and I know personally I'm not sitting here worrying about North Korean missiles lobbing over our heads. I don't think that's really the game plan, unless Kim Jong-un truly is suicidal.
I hear the music. We're heading into a break. Ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned and we'll be right back.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey water filtration systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Remember, folks, we were bringing you the specials on the 1 ounce American Gold Eagles, along with the Mint State 61 $20 Liberty Gold piece. You'll receive a free silver eagle, and they're very competitively priced. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. And I'm very pleased to join this time with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. And the website is the Corbett Report. .com. I am correct on that, am I not, James?
You are correct. It can be either thecorbettreport.com or corbettreport.com. Both of them will take you there.
And you do have a terrific website.
There's
like two or three websites I visit, and it's just facts that you have. So many of these websites are so sensationalized, you know. They have all kinds of stuff, and you know, it's like, I just want the facts. I just want the, you know, the gritty stuff. I just want the news, the facts, and that's what your website provides. So I do encourage folks to visit your website, thecorbettreport.com. And we were talking about touring the world today, and the next stop is going to be China and India. And how do they play? You know, you hear so many things about China. As far as I know, they have just as much debt as anybody else. But yet they're able to, you know, go into various areas to help out, to secure various crops and so forth. I hear they're beginning to go back into Latin America. And the other country you don't hear much about is India.
Yes. Yep.
Very, very little.
Yes. You're right about that. And so I think a couple of things. First of all, you're right that the Chinese debt situation is in some ways even more ridiculous than the Federal Reserve stimulus over the last decade. For the last several years, since the economic downturn in 2008 and the crisis, the Chinese economic dragon, the phenomenon that was happening there, did start to slow down, and the Chinese economy, the Chinese government kept that going by basically papering it over with stimulus, very much akin to what the Federal Reserve was doing. However, in the Chinese context, that was spent on infrastructure, building things, highways and roads and skyscrapers and entire cities, ghost cities that I'm sure everyone's heard about. So there was a huge infrastructure investment, which of course not only kept people employed in construction and things like that and kept the manufacturing and economy going, but also has created the space for the Chinese population to grow into, theoretically. So at the end of the day, perhaps they did a smarter version of the papering over the economy, at least smarter than just buying all these toxic treasuries and mortgage-backed securities and other things that the Fed did. But, okay, so India, how does India play into this? Well, actually, I mean, I think it's interesting to note that over the last year or two, the U.S. State Department, in conjunction with Japan and Australia, have, I think, been trying to start at least broaching this idea of a rebrand. It's no longer the Asia-Pacific. It's the Indo-Pacific, because they want to see, they're trying to make India the key linchpin ally in the region. Because India, of course, is one of one of the largest countries on the planet by population, also the fastest growing economy in the world, surpassing China in the fourth quarter of last year. So it is now officially the fastest growing economy in the world. I think 7.8% growth or 7.2%, wow. I can't remember. But anyway, it's on a tear economically, and it is seen as a potential bulwark against this Chinese juggernaut, which is starting to convert its economic power into geopolitical clout by way of its investment in infrastructure throughout the entire region. And of course, people have probably heard about the One Belt, One Road idea, this $1 trillion idea they have to create this massive infrastructure for the basically the trade route for connecting China to the rest of the world. India is potentially, if not a roadblock there, at least a challenger or a rival in that dream, because for example, one of the key elements of the One Belt, One Road policy so far has been the Chinese-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is $60 billion in commitment so far, and maybe more on the way, for infrastructure development between China and Pakistan. Obviously, India, not a big fan of Pakistan and the potential growth there, so they've been distancing themselves a little bit from China, and I think the U.S. and others are trying to play on that. Oh, well, maybe we can use India against China and kind of build them up as the regional rival to keep China in check. And so I think, yeah, we don't hear a lot about India, but I think in the coming years we're going to hear a lot more about India.
Does India have a military? I don't even know. That's
they
terrible.
They do. And, of course, a lot of it is the knife edge in Kashmir facing off against the Pakistanis, and that is literally a potential nuclear threat to the world, certainly to the region anyway. Two nuclear powers are lined up in a disputed territory and do occasionally get into some shooting wars with each other, at least skirmishes, and there have been some hairy moments recently. That's an ongoing situation, and yes, so India does maintain a military force, and it's even had some squabbles recently with China over some disputed areas, not even in India or China, but in a related area. I can't remember if India was working with Tibet to develop a road, or then the Chinese started to interfere. I can't remember the details of the situation at this point, but at any rate, there have been the potential for some skirmishes between even India and China.
So how does, and again, I mean, after you just explained India, it's like, what is their, is it their location? You know, as you said, as being their position to the investments coming from the United States and Japan and Australia, what do they have to, other than people and low wages?
Yeah. Well, exactly.
Do you know where
I think
I'm
that's
going?
Well, yeah. I think that's actually a large part of it. A large part of the foreign investment that's gone into India over the last couple of decades. I mean, for most of my life, I can remember India being hyped as the next big economic giant to take off. It's just never happened. But the idea would be it's a highly educated population that low wages. There was a big push to try to make it to go from kind of the call center area for outsourcing for American corporations into some kind of IT area for that kind of investment. Again, never really took off in a big way, especially because the country's infrastructure is electric infrastructure and other parts of the grid are significantly lagging behind. So it's not the best place for that type of investment right now, but the idea has always been the potential is there. Couple of roadblocks on that path are, one, the Indian government itself, which is notorious for red tape and bureaucracy and stifling economic innovation. And then There was a second thing that I was thinking there. Sometimes it said India's biggest advantage is it's the world's largest democracy, but India's biggest disadvantage is it's the world's largest democracy. So obviously the Indian government is not able to intervene as decisively in the markets and in what's going on in the economy as the Chinese communist government does. I think ultimately central planning always fails, but in the short term, certainly China can act more decisively and do more to actually steer their economy one way or another than the Indian government could ever possibly do.
Well, you know, you talked about China and that their debt was funneled into infrastructure building. Is this what Donald Trump is going to attempt, perhaps along those lines? Now that he's, they talk of this infrastructure that is going to be the next big project, trillions of dollars to be spent. And I keep saying, well, where's the money coming from?
Yeah.
And I heard, and I mentioned this a couple of times on the program, where the saying is, debt doesn't matter until it does. So how is this what they're going to try to accomplish, what China did, or is it just too late for the United States to do anything like that?
Well, I'll believe it when I see it, and I certainly haven't seen anything yet. So I'm not holding my breath for it either, because, yeah, I don't believe political promises like these. And the plan that's been put forward, I haven't gone into it in great detail, but from what I've seen, yes, there is no long-term funding mechanism for this that really makes me believe this is going to happen. It's kind of more of a pipe dream at this point. From just a theoretical perspective, I think as an American citizen, if I was an American citizen, it would be better if the government was spending money on infrastructure than if it was spending it on, as I say, mortgage-backed securities and other toxic things like that to keep the financial system afloat. It's still not an ideal system for the government to be spending all this money on debt, but at any rate,
they can't change that now. It's too far gone.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it has been painted into a corner. So even if you did have some, real person who truly wanted to get the system out of the place that it's in a position of power like Fed Chair or whatever, it's still a question of how you would even do that without collapsing the economy. They've set it up on such a deck of cards that anything will blow it over.
You know, you did a paper on the new Fed chair, Jerome Powell, and there was a notation that every time there was a new Fed chairman, from Greenspan to Bernanke to there's always been a large sell-off in the markets.
Yes.
Do you expect that to happen with Powell? We've had a little volatility.
Yeah.
But,
that was the point I was making. In fact, it goes back to Volcker back in 79, who came in October. Came in in August, and in October the S&P dropped 11%, and over the course of next year would drop a further 9%, so 20% overall. But that started a tradition, I guess. Greenspan comes in August 87, October 87 you have Black Monday. Bernanke comes in February 2006, May 2006 you have an 8% sell-off, and then Stearns and Lehman Brothers, that meltdown begins the next year. Yellen comes in February 2013 in the midst of a sell-off, and then that sell-off resumes in September, a 9% drop ultimately happening that year. So there's always been some sort of test, as it were, of the Fed chair. But yeah, Powell came in, the day that he came in was the day that the Dow lost. At one point, lost 1,500 points. It pared it down, so it only lost, I believe, was that the day that it only lost 666 points?
Yes.
But anyway, he came in on an interesting day, and Janet Yellen, interestingly, left on an interesting note. She gave an interview, I believe, was it CNBC? One of those types of networks. She gave an interview where she basically said something to the effect, well, we're not in a market bubble per se, but valuations are high.
Yes.
So that's an interesting thing for an outgoing Fed chair to say on her way out the door, which seems like a little bit of a pot shot at the person coming in. And I'm sure that if not contributed to the volatility, at least doesn't help it along. There's some interesting things happening right now. And an interesting aspect of that whole kerfuffle that we saw last month was well, I guess this month for you. Sorry, I'm on March 1st. I'm in a different time zone. But the,
I have another hour.
The interesting thing that happened was that that you had Powell basically being quiet during all of that. There wasn't any big pronouncement. He didn't make any. Yeah. And there was nothing really that he said. But then, of course, he comes out this week and says, well, yeah, we might raise rates four times this year. Who knows? I'll decide when we get there. So, and it's already being called his first flub to even say that. So, it's very interesting the way these things work. But basically, the point of my article was that it's very possible this might be the game of musical chairs and who's left at the end without the chair. And it might just be Powell who ends up holding the bag, as it were, for the sins of Greenspan and Bernanke and Yellen.
Well, it was certainly short-lived, but I think the volatility started last year, and it's going to continue through this year until we do have some sort of a major correction that is coming our way. When we had that big drop, usually, you know, and I didn't expect to see a Lehman's or anything like that, but sometimes you'll hear of, you know, something that broke down, and this time you didn't hear anything. Any one particular, even, you know, a brokerage or anything that actually, you know, went out of business or something like that because they couldn't cover the margins or something. So I didn't hear anything this time around. Did you?
No, I didn't.
I mean, don't you usually hear something? You know, not you per se, but isn't there usually some sort of some impact somewhere when you have that type of market correction? Or
yes,
are we just so, I don't even know what you want to call it, because it amazes me that they're doing what they're doing, and can still continue to do it.
Yes. Well, again, a lot of this is scrying the tea leaves and trying to guess at actions and reactions and what's being said and unsaid, and to a certain extent, that's a losing game whatever way you play it, so... it is interesting to see the way this is playing out, but I'm expecting that whatever happens, we're going to see some interesting months and certainly years ahead, and I think the volatility that we've experienced over the past month is really just the thin edge of the wedge of what's going to happen when the markets start discovering the recovery was not really a recovery in a true economic sense.
Well, James, it's just been a real pleasure of spending this time with you, and I look forward to doing it again. Thank you for joining me. Listeners, we'll be back the next day, and I want to thank you for joining us. And until then, be safe, good night, and God bless. Thank you, James. In my dream.